Welcome to the Real Education Podcast. I'm your host, Blake Bowles, and on this show, I interview remarkable people who think way outside the box in education. To listen to more episodes, learn more about my guests, or become a patron of this ad and sponsor-free show, visit blakebowles.com/podcast. You can also email me at yourstruly@blakebowles.com. Now, on to the show. My guest today is Misha Gulfman, founding director of Croca Expeditions in Marlow, New Hampshire. Misha, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Blake.
Tell us what Croca is, what it offers, and who it's for.
Croca is for kids ages 6 to whatever age you decide you're not a kid anymore. Most kids are done with us by age of 19, but some stay around for much longer. As a matter of fact, about 80% of our staff represent kids who stayed on with Croca. And Croca is wilderness adventure school, but those words don't quite describe what Croca really is, because we try to live our whole life here, not just part of it. So on our wilderness adventure, we grow most of the food that we take with us out on expeditions, and we make a large amount of clothing and equipment that we take into the wilderness with us. And we start our meals with a song and a ritual. And we have, when we walk by anything in the world that needs our help or any injustice, we change our itineraries. So Croca is a whole life school with the backbone of wilderness adventure.
My next question was, what separates it from other outdoor adventure programs? But you seem to have answered it. It seems to be more of a whole life philosophy, or a more holistic approach than maybe a program that just takes young people out into the wilderness and teaches them a few things and sends them back home. Is that accurate?
Yeah. If you look at our motto, where consciousness meets wilderness, the most important approach for us is to live to that and to walk our talk. And so this would make our life slightly more complicated at every juncture. If you look at a piece of equipment, you would say, where is it made and how is it made, and do we really need it? When you look at a piece of technology, you will say, the other day, after many years, I'll give you an example. The other day, after many years of needing it, we were able to purchase a four-wheel drive truck that pulled our large trailer right to the doorway. And after students unloaded, I felt sharp pain in my chest. And I realized that for previous many, many years, trailer would always get stuck being pulled by a two-wheel drive vehicle in the snow. And students would have to push and pull and work together as a team to put it in place. And then they'd have to carry their boxes a long ways to the building. And we sat down and said, wow, this is an amazing convenience, but we have lost something. So considering that at every step of our lives, what is the gain and what is the loss, and how does it affect the whole picture, and how what we do affect the society around us and the earth that we live on. That's at the heart of Croca. And so everything takes a little more time. Everything takes a little more time here, and it's worth it.
You're an accomplished wilderness adventurer, and where did you start your life, and how did you get outside?
I was born in St. Petersburg, Russia, and my family, I was born into a long-standing outdoor tradition. Every summer, my family would spend a month on a wilderness expedition, exploring waterways by small folding kayak in a group with other people, living this really awesome nomadic lifestyle, foraging and working on farms for food and fishing. And I had opportunity to learn from many elders, many mentors in my growing up years, and loved that whole lifestyle and loved making equipment in our little city apartment in between the trips, and loved dehydrating food over the stove and just all the aspects of adventure and life on the move. I was introduced to it very early and in a way that was not related to money, but was related to being crafty and finding resources that were not readily available, and spending every moment of free time out of doors, away from the city life, that was really important for our family. And traditional ways of food preservation were very important. And so the importance of this was not so much about the choice of lifestyle, but it was about the necessity for our parents to take us out for the summer, to have us live on the farm and then go on the expedition. It was a way of feeding us, because food was not available in the city, the good vitamins and good nutrition. And by traveling like this, we ate good fresh food. That was primary motivation for our folks to travel like this. And it was also very, very cheap, because you didn't need hotels or hardly anything, just what you made with your hands. So that was my growing up.
And you grew up during the time of the Soviet Union. Is that related to the food problem?
Yeah. The big centralized food distribution system had its problems.
What brought you to the United States?
Well, we were, my family was Jewish, and the desire to leave the oppressive Soviet Union lived in the family since who knows what beginning of time. And it was a long process for my grandparents, who never saw the opportunity to leave, and then my parents to leave. And when the time came, when the opportunity presented itself, I was an adult, a young adult in Soviet Union, really committed to my work with children in the outdoors, and not really wanting to leave. And so my parents left, and I stayed back and continued my work with students. Eventually, I went to the United States, visited with my parents and my sister, and still not convinced that I want to move, because I was just living a very productive life coming back to Soviet Union. However, after spending a summer in the U.S., it was hard to go back. And after that, I was like, okay, I guess I got to go. Although for my first several years of living here, I directed all of my energies back to Russian outdoor education, creating a Soviet-American outdoor educators exchange program, and doing a lot of work bringing the best I knew from Soviet outdoor education to the U.S. and the best what I've been learning in the U.S. back to Russia, and et cetera, many other initiatives. So it took me a while to land here, really.
And when you did land, you became a public school teacher. Is that correct?
Yep. I followed them once I landed here, and I already had a 2-year-old child, and I needed to feed the child. And I tried to do what I knew how to do, which was to guide. And I started working at Hurricane Island Outward Bound School. And they have wonderful program director, Kevin Slater, at the time, right during the staff training, told me, you're not going to be able to make your living. You're not going to be able to feed your family doing this work in this country. You need to go back to teaching at public school. Once you're a public school teacher, which I was, said this would be best. You go and teach at public school and continue working, doing this work on the side. And so I did become a public school teacher, and I started following the model that I brought with me from Russia. I started an outdoor program at a public school in New Hampshire and ran it for a period of years successfully, still continued to work towards something else, which eventually became Grok.
What were your experiences as a public school teacher? What did you teach, and how did you deal with the system?
Mm-hmm. I was a physical education and health teacher, which was a platform that allowed me to work in outdoor education. My outdoor education work was from grants. I had a school principal, which was incredibly supportive and wrote for grants and was able to find money for us to do for a time. Incredibly innovative outdoor education program, where every child in the school K-8 spend the entire day outdoors once a month throughout the school year. The experience was great. I loved working in the public school, and I loved developing the program. And the breaking moment for me came when the town meeting day, when the grants dried out and the town was given opportunity to vote to put the money in the next school year budget for the outdoor program, and they chose not to. And that was just realization what it's like to be at the mercy of a public like this. And that was kind of a little humbling and not a great experience for me, because I gave a lot to the community and worked hard to give opportunity to those children. And that was the time to realize that maybe public school system is not the venue for my ideas. But experience was good. I learned a lot.
What role did Outward Bound play in your thinking, and how did it shape your ideas?
Outward Bound was really important. One thing that when I started working at Outward Bound, I was struck by how little some of the instructors who worked there, how little expertise they had, not the senior staff, but the regular staff, and yet how much they knew on how to work with groups, how to bring people together, how to challenge groups to form a closer team. Those were not topics that I learned in my Russian outdoor education, in going to the National Outdoor Leadership School in Russia, becoming a guide, working with children, mentoring with adults. Never really, those were not topics that we addressed there. How do you work together as a team? How do you process your feelings? How do you work in inclusivity? How do you work with people of different, just how do you work with people with differences? And so that was my great learning at Outward Bound, how to bring people together, everything from games and initiatives to utilizing the ropes course to using so many techniques that Outward Bound had for furthering their goal of building closer relationships between people. So it was a great learning platform for me. Meeting amazing people, amazing mentors there, absorbing like a sponge, I suppose, everything from the course program areas to the way logistics and equipment and food systems worked. There was a wealth of learning for me at Outward Bound, as well as I spent 10 years guiding at Mahusik Guide Service. I spent a number of years working for a ropes course facilitation school and many other formative experiences in the U.S.
And how did all of these finally materialize in Kroka?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I was fortunate to be able to go to graduate school as a public school teacher. Had to advance my education, and the reason I was going to graduate school is there was something missing for me. I would take school kids out on outdoor experiences, and they would ask me lots of questions to which I had no answers. Those questions had to do with our relationship with the natural world and the future of the humanity and the future and the health of the earth. Those were missing parts in my education. I would work at Outward Bound, and we would use nature as the background for challenging human being. We would not take time to appreciate nature itself. It was just oftentimes there was a hostile background for challenging people, so that through this they would break down and then pull themselves back together. And it was the nature itself that intrigued me so much, and how do we relate to it on a different level. So that was the reason for me to go to graduate school. And once I had spent some time taking amazing classes at NTO Graduate School and working with amazing professors and pondering on my questions, I realized that it may not be the public school where I'm destined. I also was working as an adjunct professor at Plymouth State University, teaching outdoor education there as well. And seeing some of the limitations in front of me. And all of a sudden, I just thought, well, maybe there's something I could do that's different from everything that's going on around me. Maybe instead of putting my energy into changing existing systems, which takes a lot of energy to change, maybe I could create a new system and put all my energy into creation rather than a struggle of change.
What did Kroka look like in the beginning? What were the first programs?
Well, in the very beginning, I brought my ideas. I had a friend who I met at the graduate school, and he was a teacher at the local Montessori school. And he said, after hearing my ideas, he said, oh, why don't you come to us and test your ideas here? And so I had the opportunity to start a summer camp at the Montessori school, which gave me all the resources, the space and the vehicle that I needed to get started and publicize the programs. So at first, the program was based at the Montessori school for the first 2 years. And then we were ready to go on our own. And very wonderful people at the Montessori school encouraged us, said, Lynn and I, that we could do it. We couldn't imagine how we'd do it without having any capital. I remember going to my aunt and asking, borrowing $9,000 and buying a 15-passenger van. Matter of fact, we still have a passenger van. And people say, what are you doing with the 25-year-old 15-passenger van? Well, it runs really good. So we had no overhead costs. We had school allowed us to use its grounds. We had a 15-passenger van, and we had advantage of kids who went to that school with whom we can work in the after school by water paddling, rock climbing, winter wilderness skills program, and they formed the backbone of summer camp. And we had first summer with 35 kids. We offered Introduction to Adventure, which continues to be 21 years later, kind of our most core beginners, young children program. And we offered the Green Mountain Multi-Element Expedition, which we now call Expedition Pre-Columbus. And I remember the maps were very old. I walked down the Green Mountains in the Valley of Vermont, and there was a road, and the road was not on the map. And I was like, what kind of road is that? Only later I realized it's a Highway 7 that's been there now for probably 30 or 40 years, but it wasn't on the map, and I've never been there before. It was a great adventure. We went from 35 to kids in the first summer to 85 kids in the second summer, and then one of the staff members who we hired said, I'd like for you to come to my farm, and I'd like for you to look. I think we have a better place for your programs than being in town where you're right now. And that's how we moved to Trollhuggin Farm in Newfane, Vermont. We spent a decade or so there, an amazing, beautiful place. And then we were able to find our own home here.
So it sounds like Kroka offered a lot of shorter term wilderness skills and wilderness immersion programs. And then you came around to offering a longer program, a semester program. And it seems like those programs have really taken off. Where did the idea for the semester program come from?
It comes from kids, from students themselves. The students would, at the end of the summer, they would say, I wish I could live like we're living at Kroka. I wish I don't have to go home. I wish I could live that way during the year. I wish I could go to school at Kroka. And so there was eventually, little by little, the idea developed of this expedition that would go from Kroka to Canada on ski. I've heard of this trail, Catamount Trail, that was being developed that followed the lengths of Vermont. And I remember one morning waking up on the shore of Maine coast, and the girl, 16-year-old girl, saying, so when do you think this is going to happen? You keep talking about this idea of school at Kroka. When do you think it's going to happen? And I looked at her and I said, it's going to happen next winter. Let's do it. And we did.
Tell me more about the cross-country skiing semester program. Where do they go? What kind of physical challenges are involved? How many kids do it?
So we take 14 students on each semester program, and this is the maximum number of students we feel we could have in a kind of environment, in an expedition environment. We have a month of preparation here at Kroka Village. During that time, students make their own knives, they make their own expedition anoraks, they learn how to ski. Many of them have never skied before, so we have daily backcountry ski lessons, as well as we take them to a ski mountain, as well as we take them to a ski center. So they ski every day, and they could take on the expedition. Their curriculum, academic curriculum, is centered around expedition preparation. Each student has a job, an important role in the community. Like, one of them is a navigator, another one of them is expedition food manager, while the other one is a base camp food manager. So they have very real responsibilities and adult mentors to work with. And we prepare for a 300-mile winter expedition, and then we start right from base camp, and we ski from here to almost Canadian border, which takes us 2 months, and it's about 300 miles long. At the moment, we are just about over about two-thirds of the way into the expedition.
Are you skiing through public land or private land with access grants?
We're skiing through Green Mountain National Forest. We're skiing through private lands, through innumerable number of private land holdings. We're skiing through hundred ski centers strewn along the backbone of Green Mountains of Vermont. And we're following, a lot of the times we're following the Catamount Trail, and a lot of times we aren't. So it's a mixture of public and private lands we're skiing through, and we are not trying to be in the wilderness. We're in the wilderness every night when we're camping, but our trail is running through active logging operations, people's farms, sugar bush, and everything that the life, good life in Vermont has to offer. And part of students' experience is learning how to interview folks, how to ask for help, how to ask for water when they're passing by someone's house, how to interact with people and feel a sense of community in a larger world around them.
I love how you've created this combination of a wilderness, a serious wilderness experience, a physical challenge, a camping challenge, with an urban or small town, say, experience that it feels like a sort of a Lord of the Rings style epic adventure. Is that a justified analogy?
Sure, that's a great analogy. But it's really, really on purpose, because when modern people oftentimes think about wilderness experience, they think big national parks, or they think Alaska. How do we preserve open spaces? We need to love open spaces all around us. I have a premise that there is wilderness everywhere. We paddle rivers that people don't usually paddle. We hike areas where people don't usually hike. We don't hesitate to walk through someone's land and knock on someone's door and say, can we camp in your woods this evening? Can we walk through? And in this meetings, while sure, once in a while they could be uncomfortable, but most of the time people are just so welcoming and happy. And it's about changing culture around us, changing this culture of privacy, changing culture of private landholding with posted no trespassing signs. It's creating culture of trust, saying it's wonderful for people to walk through my land. And not only they will walk through my land, they will pick up trash, they will fix the birdhouse, they will contribute to service. And we want for our students to have excitement for life, excitement for creating communities where they are and seeing and trusting people and seeing the world as an extension of their family.
Where do you think these philosophical ideas came from for you? Because these are pretty outside the norm, as you said, for wilderness expeditions, which typically just focus on being away from people and civilization, and don't deal with the messy aspect of having to go and ask a stranger for water or for camping permission, or to deal with those sort of societal challenges. What inspired you to make such a different program?
Well, it's a combination of things. Well, number one, remember, I grew up in Soviet Union where there was no private property, where all the property was public. And so that's certainly one place where I witnessed this, having a lot of colleagues who grew up in Northern Europe and Scandinavia and in other European countries where there's a clear right of way for through any private properties for recreational activities, and land is open. That's another inspiration. The other inspiration is working with indigenous people, both in Russia, in Northern Canada, and in South America, and learning the attitudes of First Nations towards the land, and just really wishing to foster an attitude that land does not belong to us, that we belong to the land. And if there is a resource that's entrusted to us, such as inherited property or property that we're able to buy, all we're doing is we're buying a privilege to use this resource. And like anything else, the best way to use it is to share it with others. And it's a paradigm shift. It takes a lot of work and really figuring out, and it just goes to the core of some of our bigger issues that we're dealing with possessiveness and this idea that we can own the planet is just a strange idea if we really come to think of it. And we are not afraid to challenge this notion with our students in a respectful way.
Tell me about the Ecuador semester. That was the first semester program that was developed in CROCA, correct?
No, the first semester program is Vermont semester, which
I'm wrong.
As we travel, if I just can finish to say, you know, as we travel north and we arrive at our northern base camp, we then return home. It's a complete round trip. As the winter changes to spring, we paddle our whitewater canoes down to Lake Champlain. Then we row the handmade rowboats along the Lake Champlain, and then we bike all the way back home. So we do a complete circumnavigation of Vermont on the winter semester that goes from January to June. And all our study is intrinsically connected to places where we travel, and we have in-depth study in literature, natural history, and human history of where we travel from. So it's a really, really strong academic program, in addition to an amazing 700-mile continuous expedition. So back to the Ecuador program. Now, this program has its own beginning. Its beginning is in the group of apprentices that came to CROCA from Ecuador, the three brothers. As every year we take apprentices who come here to learn, and they came from Ecuador. And at that time, we didn't know even where Ecuador was, but they told us and they invited us to visit. And we were just blown away by an amazing place, an amazing farm, in the heart of the Andes, with lovely group of indigenous people working side by side to just create something really, really different and somewhat utopian and just really, really rich that does not at all exist here, no matter how much we love Vermont and New Hampshire or even Northern Canada, where we spend a lot of time. It's just so, so different. That was okay. It's worth the fuel to travel there, to see the generosity of this people, to see how people could be genuinely happy living in a little hut with a thatched roof and a dirt floor and owning just one pair of clothes that they wear on their back, yet they could have this such a genuine smile on their face and feel the greatness of each day in a way that we just don't seem to know how to do anymore. So that was the birth of our Ecuador program. And Ecuador program is slightly different in scope because it's not a one continuous expedition. It's two expeditions, each returning back to the farm. They preserve all the same elements, you know, what is core to CROCA. It's a high adventure, fairly high, good element of risk. it's a mixture of traveling in the wilderness and immersing in the villages and living with people and serving people along the way. It's same autonomy to students and the great degree of responsibilities and fairly good solid learning of skills, because in Ecuador we travel from the highlands down to the jungle, and then we travel by bike and by boat, by paddling boat, and then we travel on foot from the farm to the highest volcano, to Cotopaxi, and we climb. We do glacier school and we climb the volcano. So there's a pretty good long
wow.
expeditions.
What kind of kids enroll in your semester programs? They're during the school year, and so I assume that most of the participants are taking a full semester off to make this possible. What are their shared motivations or characteristics?
That's great. Well, the beautiful thing for us is that we don't have one type of student who enrolls in our program, and that's a strength. I'd say we have two types, maybe more. So one type of student is student who is highly successful academically in school and highly motivated, driven, strong-willed student who is questioning the establishment and questioning the way they are. They're about to graduate from high school and they're about to go to some high-powered college, and all of a sudden they have a question. Is this all really true? Is this how it is? Or is there more to life than was being presented to me in my AP classes? So that's one kind of student that we have. That I would characterize, this is a student who we really need them because they form an important part of the group, but they will do fine without us. If we weren't around, they would find their way. The second kind of a student that we have is a lost student. It's a student that would be incredibly talented, and their talents may be overshadowed by some of their learning challenges or some of their social inhibition. They are in school and they don't feel sense of belonging. They don't feel sense of connection. The traditional school system doesn't make sense to them. They do not want to confirm. They do not want to adhere, and they do not fit in one of the boxes. They presented with few boxes to fit into, and they don't fit into any of those boxes, and they're looking for their identity, and they come here where they're asked to be who they are and to take time to figure out who are they. And maybe they need to create their own box, or maybe they don't fit in the box at all. Maybe they need a sphere. So that's a second kind of student that we have. I say in terms of, like, we have public school kids, we have homeschoolers, we have kids who come from Waldorf schools or other alternative schools, just really all across the board. And we have kids who already done a year at college and then they say, that is not working for me. It does not make sense. I need to travel within. I need to travel within me. I need to find out who am I. Homeschoolers, college kids, we have a whole range of wonderful students. They're all, though, amazing. They all have one thing in common, is they want to be here. We would never take a student who does not desire to be here. And prior to being here, they have to train. They have to physically, seriously train to be ready for what's put in front of them. They need to dehydrate a whole bunch of food in preparation for their journey. So they have to be serious about wanting to be here. We'd never take someone, if their parents say, we want you to just go to Croca, we will say no.
I love that requirement as a condition of enrollment. And I do the same thing with my own programs. And I interview participants to make sure that nobody's being put up to this by their parents, because that's just not going to end up in a good situation for anyone. What is the connection between Croca and Waldorf?
Sure. So my partner, Lynn, was a Waldorf kindergarten teacher for a number of years, and we have educated 3 out of our 4 children in the Waldorf tradition. And at some point in Croca's life, we were approached by Waldorf school to conduct a class trip, and after the class trip we noticed that it is very interesting to work with Waldorf schools, that students are much more prepared to take what we offer to them compared to some of the other students. They were, they had ability to listen really well. They knew how to work with their hands already. They already had beautiful singing voices. There's a lot of alignment to what we were doing. So we discovered that the philosophy and work of Rudolf Steiner, and were able to take a lot of this and also then see over time that at the time when Rudolf Steiner came with Waldorf education to the world, some of the challenges were not the same as they are today. And so while we are students of Waldorf education, we also realize that we need to go further and beyond the prescribed methods, because there was no methods prescribed for educating children in harmony with nature, for providing opportunities to love to be outside, because at that time people probably were still outside quite a bit just by the necessity of life. And the biggest part, I suppose, where we need to work is the will, development of the will, because the realization that the modern child has an undeveloped will force, and all the opportunities that are in front of them presented by our incredibly wealthy civilization with a wealth of opportunities, those opportunities are not taken advantage of very often because the young person lacks the will to act on what's available to them. And that is where our work comes in. It's probably our primary work, is helping young people to invoke their own will force to do good in the world.
What motivates you to work primarily with teenagers as opposed to younger children, or as opposed to older people in their 20s or 30s?
Well, we actually do quite a lot of work with younger children. We wouldn't have been able to offer a semester program if we didn't work with younger children. Our 350 summer campers, probably vast majority of them fall somewhere between age 11 and 15. But the working with teenagers on a semester-long program is just so awesome, because on one hand, these are young people who are still full of idealism for the world. They believe that everything is possible, which, by the way, I do too. And so there's no cynicism in them. There's no need to spend a lot of time dissolving the darkness and the cynicism that some of the young people have at a later time in their life when they've been disillusioned. So this is not a disillusioned crowd. And yet they have opportunity already. They've developed critical thinking. They've developed their physical bodies are developed so they can push themselves. They could carry a full-size backpack. They could learn. You could start teaching them in many different ways. You could start bringing analytical information to them. You could really teach them how to paddle, climb, not just show them. So I'd say it's like a cusp. It's a great age. You can make a huge difference at that time, because the human being is hungry for learning, is able to learn, and yet has not been discouraged by the world from learning everything that's around them. That's why teenagers.
I agree, and those are the same reasons that I work with teenagers myself. It seems like a golden opportunity window that you can't really get when they're 11, and it's much more difficult to get when they're 21.
And the other thing about this is too that the way it works in our society is people treasure their children when they're children, and then they need their adults to join the workforce. And this whole time of being a teenager, people tend to be afraid of teenagers and really disempower them. There's no good place for them. They are not children anymore. They're perfectly capable of working hard and being useful. It's just giving them opportunity for being useful. Everybody wants to be of use. And if you're not of use, if nobody's needing you because you're not yet a consumer and you're not yet join the workforce, then what are you supposed to do? You're going to get into trouble and of every sort, because how can you go about living in a society that does not need you, that locks you in a school, that locks you in places, it just tells you, you just need to learn. The rest of the time, just stay out of the way. Just keep on learning. We'll need you later. We need them right now. Now, our teenagers split 30 cords of wood here. They cook all their food. They shovel miles of snow path. We need their work. The way Kroka is structured, the farm wouldn't work if we didn't have those wonderful, hardworking kids, etc.
I'm nodding my head vigorously over here. You can't see it, but I'm so with you. What kind of personal transformations have you witnessed in this work through teenagers or younger or older folks?
Mm-hmm. Well, so for sure you could say that, you know, 6 months spent living in nature is transformational. And I should probably not say that's because of Kroka, it's just because of the fact. Just take any human being, put them out completely in a different environment from where they are. Say that you have to split your firewood, shovel your snow path, cook 3 meals a day, and travel 700 miles. It just by nature of the fact of it, it will be transformational. So I would say, yes, program is transformational. How much of this transformation is us versus how much of this transformation is all the forces of nature around us, I'm not sure. After some time of living outside and traveling, the world start working on you in amazing ways. You know, I look at the eyes of the people, and their eyes are very, very different. Their eyes have this depth and clarity in them. The way they interact with each other, the opportunity to really, I mean, how often in the modern life can you spend 2 hours a day just sitting and listening to other people share about their lives without being in a rush to go somewhere? It's an amazing opportunity for transformation. The question always is, what happens next? How can you make the short-term transformation measurably affect your life? And that's a hard question to answer, because you look at students at graduation day and your heart jumps with joy. Yet a few months later, someone could be back to destructive patterns in their life. It's a possibility too. So we cannot overestimate what we could do, because we cannot change anybody. People can, you know, we can give people opportunity to change. It's up to them whether they're going to change or not. And it's all about will. Now, once everybody, of course, who doesn't want to change? Everybody wants to do better. Then it's just a question of, in 6 months of time, can we really give someone support that they need to make a long-term, permanent change? And that is why we are working on creating a year-long program now. The semester is not long enough, and we need to go longer. And that is also why majority of our semester students are alumni of our short-term programs. And so this is a multi-year commitment that really, if anything is going to produce a change, it's a consistent multi-year commitment.
Misha, I'd like to close on a personal question. You've chosen a line of work that is physically demanding, because I know you participate in a lot of the wilderness expeditions. It's mentally demanding and it's emotionally demanding. What keeps you doing this? What keeps you showing up for work each day?
Well, I'd say that being out on the expedition is a lot less demanding than being in the office today. And I'd do much better work answering your questions if we were skiing side by side. I would speak with a lot more ease. So I love the living outdoors. It's not a strain on me. And I see my family over the course of my life. My four boys only about 50% of the time, but the 50% of the time I see them are really rich and special, and every day is a gift when I'm with my family. When I'm out on an expedition, my family is my students, and I have ability to not think about anything else, but just be right where I am, and that's a gift that I am blessed with, to just be able to be where I am and be happy with that. The expeditions themselves are not all that physically challenging. I mean, they are physically challenging, but I love the challenge, and I love the healthy lifestyle, and I love the beating of the weather on my body. And that's all good. The returning back is where the challenges are for me, coming back into the office environment with 250 emails waiting for me and tremendous amount of office work. The price that I have to pay as the director of the organization for spending 50% of my time in the field, that price is really high and sometimes unsustainable. You know, getting up at 4 a.m. and putting in very, very long days. I'm fortunate. You know, I do not know anyone else in my position who is able to spend so much time in the outdoors. Being with teenagers is not work for me. It's being out on an expedition is a paid vacation. I'm sorry. I know I've insulted many people by saying this before, but when I go on vacation with my children, I go on a wilderness expedition, except that my children, they're not always going to listen to their father. They're going to argue. Well, students don't argue. Students are respectful. They listen really well. So I cannot complain. What keeps me going? I love the lifestyle. I love to share what I know with kids. I see it going by the wayside. You know, the ways we travel, the many things that we teach here, how freedom of being able to teach students how to drink wild water, how to cook their food on fire, how to walk barefoot. That longest us alive. That's what keeps me going. Good life. We're living a good life here. Easy to keep going, Blake.
My guest today has been Misha Golfman. Thank you, Misha, for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
This is the Real Education Podcast. This show is produced with the assistance of Zen Zenith, who also created the music. For more episodes, visit blakebowles.com/podcast. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.